Those varieties of replicator that happen to be good at getting copied become more numerous at the expense of alternative replicators that are bad at getting copied. That, at its most rudimentary, is natural selection. The archetypal replicator is a gene, a stretch of DNA that is duplicated, nearly always with extreme accuracy, through an indefinite number of generations. The central question for meme theory is whether there are units of cultural imitation which behave as true replicators like genes. I am not saying that memes necessarily are close analogues of genes, only that the more like genes they are, the better will meme theory work, and the purpose of this section is to ask whether meme theory might work for the special case of religion.
In the world of genes, the occasional flaws in replication, mutations, see to it that the gene pool contains alternative variants of any given gene, alleles, which may therefore be seen as competing with each other. Competing for what? For the particular chromosomal slot or locus that belongs to that set of alleles. And how do they compete? Not by direct molecule-to-molecule combat, but by proxy. The proxies are their phenotypic traits, things like leg length or fur colour, manifestations of genes fleshed out as anatomy, physiology, biochemistry or behaviour. A gene's fate is normally bound up with the bodies in which it successively sits. To the extent that it influences those bodies, it affects its own chances of surviving in the gene pool. As the generations go by, genes increase or decrease in frequency in the gene pool by virtue of their phenotypic proxies. Might the same be true of memes? One respect in which they are not like genes is that there is nothing obviously corresponding to chromosomes or loci, or alleles or sexual recombination. The meme pool is less structured and less organized than the gene pool. Nevertheless, it's not obviously silly to speak of a meme pool, in which particular memes might have a frequency which can change as a consequence of competitive interactions with alternative memes. Some people have objected to mimetic explanations on various grounds that usually stem from the fact that memes are not entirely like genes. The exact physical nature of a gene is now known. It is a sequence of DNA, whereas that of memes is not, and different mimeticists confuse one another by switching from one physical medium to another. Do memes exist only in brains? Or is every paper copy and electronic copy of, say, a particular limerick also entitled to be called a meme? Then again, genes replicate with very high fidelity, whereas if memes replicate at all, don't they do so with low accuracy? These alleged problems of memes are exaggerated. The most important objection is the allegation that memes are copied with insufficiently high fidelity to function as Darwinian replicators. The suspicion is that if the mutation rate in every generation is high, the meme will mutate itself out of existence before Darwinian selection can have an impact on its frequency in the meme pool. But the problem is illusory. Think of a master carpenter, or a prehistoric flint knapper, demonstrating a particular skill to a young apprentice. If the apprentice faithfully reproduced every hand movement of the master, you would indeed expect to see the meme mutate out of all recognition in a few generations of master-apprentice transmission. But of course the apprentice does not faithfully reproduce every hand movement. It would be ridiculous to do so. Instead, he notes the goal that the master is trying to achieve and imitates that. Drive in the nail until the head is flush, using as many hammer blows as it takes, which may not be the same number as the master used. It is such rules that can pass unmutated down an indefinite number of imitation generations, no matter that the details of their execution may vary from individual to individual and from case to case. Stitches in knitting, knots in ropes or fishing nets, origami folding patterns, useful tricks in carpentry or pottery, all can be reduced to discrete elements that really do have the opportunity to pass down an indefinite number of imitation generations without alteration. The details may wander idiosyncratically, but the essence passes down unmutated, and that is all that is needed for the analogy of memes with genes to work.
In my foreword to Susan Blackmore's The Meme Machine, I developed the example of an origami procedure for making a model Chinese junk. It's quite a complicated recipe involving 32 folding or similar operations. The end result, the Chinese junk itself, is a pleasing object, as are at least three intermediate stages in the embryology, namely the catamaran, the box with two lids, and the picture frame. The whole performance does indeed remind me of the foldings and invaginations that the membranes of an embryo undergo as it morphs itself from blastula to gastrula to neurula. I learned to make the Chinese junk as a boy from my father, who at about the same age had acquired the skill at his boarding school. A craze for making Chinese junks, initiated by the school matron, had spread through the school in his time like a measles epidemic, then died away also like a measles epidemic. 26 years later, when that matron was long gone, I went to the same school. I reintroduced the craze, and it again spread like another measles epidemic, and then again died away. The fact that such a teachable skill can spread like an epidemic tells us something important about the high fidelity of mimetic transmission. We may be sure that the junks made by my father's generation of schoolboys in the 1920s were in no general respect different from those made by my generation in the 1950s.
We could investigate the phenomenon more systematically by the following experiment. A variant of the childhood game of Chinese whispers. American children call it telephone. Take 200 people who've never made a Chinese junk before and line them up in 20 teams of 10 people each. Gather the heads of the 20 teams around a table and teach them, by demonstration, how to make a Chinese junk. Now send each one off to find the second person in his own team and teach that person alone, again by demonstration, to make a Chinese junk. Each second generation person then teaches the third person in her own team, and so on, until the 10th member of every team has been reached. Keep all the junks made along the way and label them by their team and generation number for subsequent inspection.
I haven't done the experiment yet, I'd like to, but I have a strong prediction of what the result will be. My prediction is that not all of the 20 teams will succeed in passing the skill intact down the line to their 10th members, but that a significant number of them will. In some of the teams there will be mistakes, perhaps a weak link in the chain will forget some vital step in the procedure, and everyone downstream of the mistake will then obviously fail. Perhaps Team 4 gets as far as the catamaran, but falters thereafter. Perhaps the 8th member of Team 13 produces a mutant somewhere between the box with two lids and the picture frame, and the 9th and 10th members of his team then copy the mutated version. Now, of those teams in which the skill is transferred successfully to the 10th generation, I make a further prediction. If you rank the junks in order of generation, you will not see a systematic deterioration of quality with generation number. If, on the other hand, you were to run an experiment identical in all respects except that the skill transferred was not origami but copying a drawing of a junk, there would definitely be a systematic deterioration in the accuracy with which the Generation 1 pattern survived to Generation 10.
In the drawing version of the experiment, all the Generation 10 drawings will bear some slight resemblance to the Generation 1 drawing, and within each team, the resemblance would more or less steadily deteriorate as you proceed down the generations. In the origami version of the experiment, by contrast, the mistakes would be all or none. They'd be digital mutations. Either a team would make no mistakes, and the Generation 10 junk would be no worse and no better on average than that produced by Generation 5 or Generation 1, or there would be a mutation in some particular generation, and all downstream efforts would be complete failures, often faithfully reproducing the mutation. What is the crucial difference between the two skills? It is that the origami skill consists of a series of discrete actions, none of which is difficult to perform in itself. Mostly the operations are things like fold both sides into the middle, A particular team member may execute the step ineptly, but it will be clear to the next team member down the line what he is trying to do. The origami steps are self-normalizing. It is this that makes them digital. It is like the master carpenter, whose intention to flatten the nail head in the wood is obvious to his apprentice, regardless of the details of the hammer blows. Either you get a given step of the origami recipe right, or you don't. The drawing skill, by contrast, is an analog skill. Everybody can have a go, but some people copy a drawing more accurately than others, and nobody copies it perfectly. The accuracy of the copy depends, too, on the amount of time and care devoted to it, and these are continuously variable quantities. Some team members, moreover, will embellish and improve, rather than strictly copy, the preceding model. Words, at least when they're understood, are self-normalizing in the same kind of way as origami operations. In the original game of Chinese whispers, telephone, the first child is told a story or a sentence and is asked to pass it on to the next child and so on. If the sentence is less than about 7 words in the native language of all the children, there is a good chance that it will survive, unmutated, down 10 generations. If it is an unknown foreign language, so that the children are forced to imitate phonetically rather than word by word, the message does not survive. The pattern of decay down the generations is then the same as for a drawing, and it will become garbled. When the message makes sense in the children's own language and doesn't contain any unfamiliar words like phenotype or allele, it survives. Instead of mimicking the sounds phonetically, each child recognizes each word as a member of a finite vocabulary and selects the same word, although very probably pronounced in a different accent, when passing it on to the next child. Written language is also self-normalizing because the squiggles on paper, no matter how much they may differ in detail, are all drawn from a finite alphabet of, say, 26 letters.
The fact that memes can sometimes display very high fidelity due to self-normalizing processes of this kind is enough to answer some of the commonest objections that are raised to the meme gene analogy. In any case, the main purpose of meme theory at this early stage of its development is not to supply a comprehensive theory of culture on a par with Watson-Crick genetics. My original purpose in advocating memes, indeed, was to counter the impression that the gene was the only Darwinian game in town, an impression that the selfish gene was otherwise at risk of conveying. Peter Richardson and Robert Boyd emphasize the point in the title of their valuable and thoughtful book, Not by Genes Alone, although they give reasons for not adopting the word meme itself, preferring cultural variance. Stephen Shannon's Genes, Memes, and Human History was partly inspired by an earlier, excellent book by Boyd and Richardson, Culture and the Evolutionary Process. Other book-length treatments of memes include Robert Ongar's The Electric Meme, Kate Distin's The Selfish Meme, and Virus of the Mind, The New Science of the Meme, by Richard Brody. But it is Susan Blackmore in The Meme Machine who has pushed mimetic theory further than anyone. She repeatedly visualizes a world full of brains, or other receptacles or conduits, such as computers or radio frequency bands, and memes jostling to occupy them. As with genes in a gene pool, the memes that prevail will be the ones that are good at getting themselves copied. This may be because they have direct appeal, as presumably the immortality meme has for some people, or it may be because they flourish in the presence of other memes that have already become numerous in the meme pool. This gives rise to meme complexes or memeplexes. As usual with memes, we gain understanding by going back to the genetic origin of the analogy. For didactic purposes, I treated genes as though they were isolated units acting independently. But of course, they are not independent of one another, and this fact shows itself in 2 ways. First, genes are linearly strung along chromosomes, and so tend to travel through generations in the company of particular other genes that occupy neighboring chromosomal loci. We doctors call that kind of linkage linkage, and I shall say no more about it because memes don't have chromosomes, alleles, or sexual recombination. The other respect in which genes are not independent is very different from genetic linkage, and here there is a good mimetic analogy. It concerns embryology, which, the fact is often misunderstood, is completely distinct from genetics. Bodies are not jigsawed together as mosaics of phenotypic pieces, each one contributed by a different gene. There is no one-to-one mapping between genes and units of anatomy or behaviour. Genes collaborate with hundreds of other genes in programming the developmental processes that culminate in a body, in the same kind of way as the words of a recipe collaborate in a cookery process that culminates in a dish. It is not the case that each word of the recipe corresponds to a different morsel of the dish.
Genes then cooperate in cartels to build bodies, and that is one of the important principles of embryology. It is tempting to say that natural selection favours cartels of genes in a kind of group selection between alternative cartels. That is confusion. What really happens is that the other genes of the gene pool constitute a major part of the environment in which each gene is selected versus its alleles. Because each is selected to be successful in the presence of the others, which are also being selected in a similar way, cartels of cooperating genes emerge. We have here something more like a free market than a planned economy. There is a butcher and a baker, but perhaps a gap in the market for a candlestick maker. The invisible hand of natural selection fills the gap. That is different from having a central planner who favours the troika of butcher plus baker plus candlestick maker. The idea of cooperating cartels assembled by the invisible hand will turn out to be central to our understanding of religious memes and how they work.
Different kinds of gene cartel emerge in different gene pools. Carnivore gene pools have genes that program prey-detecting sense organs, prey-catching claws, carnassial teeth, meat-digesting enzymes, and many other genes, all fine-tuned to cooperate with each other. At the same time, in herbivore gene pools, different sets of mutually compatible genes are favoured for their cooperation with each other. We are familiar with the idea that a gene is favoured for the compatibility of its phenotype with the external environment of the species, desert, woodland, or whatever it is. The point I am now making is that it is also favoured for its compatibility with the other genes of its particular gene pool. A carnivore gene would not survive in a herbivore gene pool, and vice versa. In the long gene's eye view, the gene pool of the species, the set of genes that are shuffled and reshuffled by sexual reproduction, constitutes the genetic environment in which each gene is selected for its capacity to cooperate. Although meme pools are less regimented and structured than gene pools, we can still speak of a meme pool as an important part of the environment of each meme in the memeplex. A memeplex is a set of memes which, while not necessarily being good survivors on their own, are good survivors in the presence of other members of the memeplex. In the previous section, I doubted that the details of language evolution are favoured by any kind of natural selection. I guess that language evolution is instead governed by random drift. It is just conceivable that certain vowels or consonants carry better than others through mountainous terrain, and therefore might become characteristic of, say, Swiss, Tibetan, or Andean dialects, while other sounds are suitable for whispering in dense forests, and are therefore characteristic of Pygmy and Amazonian languages. But the one example I cited of language being naturally selected, the theory that the great vowel shift might have a functional explanation, is not of this type. Rather, it has to do with memes fitting in with mutually compatible memeplexes. One vowel shifted first for reasons unknown, perhaps fashionable imitation of an admired or powerful individual, as is alleged to be the origin of the Spanish lisp. Never mind how the great vowel shift started. According to this theory, once the first vowel had changed, other vowels had to shift in its train to reduce ambiguity, and so on in cascade. In the second stage of the process, memes were selected against the background of already existing meme pools, building up a new memeplex of mutually compatible memes. We are finally equipped to turn to the memetic theory of religion. Some religious ideas, like some genes, might survive because of absolute merit. These memes would survive in any meme pool, regardless of the other memes that surround them. I must repeat the vitally important point that merit, in this sense, means only ability to survive in the pool. It carries no value judgment apart from that. Some religious ideas survive because they are compatible with other memes that are already numerous in the meme pool as part of a memeplex. The following is a partial list of religious memes that might plausibly have survival value in the meme pool, either because of absolute merit or because of compatibility with an existing memeplex.
You will survive your own death.
If you die a martyr, you will go to an especially wonderful part of paradise, where you will enjoy 72 virgins. Spare a thought for the unfortunate virgins.
Heretics, blasphemers, and apostates should be killed, or otherwise punished, for example, by ostracism from their families.
Belief in God is a supreme virtue. If you find your belief wavering, work hard at restoring it, and beg God to help your unbelief. In my discussion of Pascal's wager, I mentioned the odd assumption that the one thing God really wants of us is belief. At the time, I treated it as an oddity. Now we have an explanation for it.
Faith, belief without evidence, is a virtue. The more your beliefs defy the evidence, the more virtuous you are. Virtuoso believers, who can manage to believe something really weird, unsupported and insupportable, in the teeth of evidence and reason, are especially highly rewarded.
Everybody, even those who do not hold religious beliefs, must respect them with a higher level of automatic and unquestioned respect than that accorded to other kinds of belief.
There are some weird things, such as the Trinity, transubstantiation, incarnation, that we are not meant to understand. Don't even try to understand one of these, for the attempt might destroy it. Learn how to gain fulfillment in calling it a mystery.
Beautiful music, art, and scriptures are themselves self-replicating tokens of religious ideas. Different schools and genres of art can be analysed as alternative memeplexes, as artists copy ideas and motifs from earlier artists, and new motifs survive only if they mesh with others. Indeed, the whole academic discipline of history of art, with its sophisticated tracing of iconographies and symbolisms, could be seen as an elaborate study in memeplexity. Details will have been favoured or disfavoured by the presence of existing members of the meme pool, and these will often include religious memes.
Some of the above list probably have absolute survival value and would flourish in any memeplex. But as with genes, some memes survive only against the right background of other memes, leading to the build-up of alternative memeplexes. Two different religions might be seen as two alternative memeplexes. Perhaps Islam is analogous to a carnivorous gene complex, Buddhism to a herbivorous one. The ideas of one religion are not better than those of the other in any absolute sense, any more than carnivorous genes are better than herbivorous ones. Religious memes of this kind don't necessarily have any absolute aptitude for survival. Nevertheless, they are good in the sense that they flourish in the presence of other memes of their own religion, but not in the presence of memes of the other religion. On this model, Roman Catholicism and Islam, say, were not necessarily designed by individual people, but evolved separately as alternative collections of memes that flourish in the presence of other members of the same memeplex.
Organized religions are organized by people, by priests and bishops, rabbis, imams and ayatollahs. But to reiterate the point I made with respect to Martin Luther, that doesn't mean they were conceived and designed by people. Even where religions have been exploited and manipulated to the benefit of powerful individuals, the strong possibility remains that the detailed form of each religion has been largely shaped by unconscious evolution. Not by genetic natural selection, which is too slow to account for the rapid evolution and divergence of religions. The role of genetic natural selection in the story is to provide the brain, with its predilections and biases, the hardware platform and low-level system software which forms the background to mimetic selection. Given this background, mimetic natural selection of some kind seems to me to offer a plausible account of the detailed evolution of particular religions. In the early stages of a religion's evolution, before it becomes organized, simple memes survive by virtue of their universal appeal to human psychology. This is where the meme theory of religion and the psychological byproduct theory of religion overlap. The later stages, where a religion becomes organized, elaborate, and arbitrarily different from other religions, are quite well handled by the theory of memeplexes, cartels of mutually compatible memes. This doesn't rule out the additional role of deliberate manipulation by priests and others. Religions probably are, at least in part, intelligently designed, as are schools and fashions in art. One religion that was intelligently designed, almost in its entirety, is Scientology, but I suspect that it is exceptional. Another candidate for a purely designed religion is Mormonism. Joseph Smith, its enterprisingly mendacious inventor, went to the lengths of composing a complete new holy book, the Book of Mormon, inventing from scratch a whole new bogus American history written in bogus 17th century English. Mormonism, however, has evolved since it was fabricated in the 19th century and has now become one of the respectable mainstream religions of America. Indeed, it claims to be the fastest growing one, and there is talk of fielding a presidential candidate. Most religions evolve. Whatever theory of religious evolution we adopt, it has to be capable of explaining the astonishing speed with which the process of religious evolution, given the right conditions, can take off. A case study follows.
Cargo cults. In the life of Brian, one of the many things the Monty Python team got right was the extreme rapidity with which a new religious cult can get started. It can spring up almost overnight and then become incorporated into a culture where it plays a disquietingly dominant role. The cargo cults of Pacific Melanesia and New Guinea provide the most famous real-life example. The entire history of some of these cults, from initiation to expiry, is wrapped up within living memory. Unlike the cult of Jesus, the origins of which are not reliably attested, we can see the whole course of events laid out before our eyes, and even here, as we shall see, some details are now lost. It is fascinating to guess that the cult of Christianity almost certainly began in very much the same way, and spread initially at the same high speed.
My main authority for the cargo cults is David Attenborough's Quest in Paradise, which he very kindly presented to me. The pattern is the same for all of them, from the earliest cults in the 19th century to the more famous ones that grew up in the aftermath of the Second World War. It seems that in every case the islanders were bowled over by the wondrous possessions of the white immigrants to their islands, including administrators, soldiers, and missionaries. They were perhaps the victims of Arthur C. Clarke's third law, which I quoted in Chapter 2. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. The islanders noticed that the white people who enjoyed these wonders never made them themselves. When articles needed repairing, they were sent away, and new ones kept arriving as cargo, in ships or later planes. No white man was ever seen to make or repair anything, nor indeed did they do anything that could be recognized as useful work of any kind. Sitting behind a desk shuffling papers was obviously some kind of religious devotion. Evidently, then, the cargo must be of supernatural origin. As if in corroboration of this, the white men did do certain things that could only have been ritual ceremonies.
They build tall masts with wires attached to them. They sit listening to small boxes that glow with light and emit curious noises and strangled voices. They persuade the local people to dress up in identical clothes and march them up and down, and it would hardly be possible to devise a more useless occupation than that. And then the native realizes that he has stumbled on the answer to the mystery. It is these incomprehensible actions that are the rituals employed by the white man to persuade the gods to send the cargo. If the native wants the cargo, then he too must do these things.
It is striking that similar cargo cults sprang up independently on islands that were widely separated both geographically and culturally. David Attenborough tells us that
anthropologists have noted two separate outbreaks in New Caledonia, four in the Solomons, four in Fiji, seven in the New Hebrides, and over 50 in New Guinea, most of them being quite independent and unconnected with one another. The majority of these religions claim that one particular Messiah will bring the cargo when the day of the apocalypse arrives.
The independent flowering of so many independent but similar cults suggests some unifying features of human psychology in general. One famous cult on the island of Tanna in the New Hebrides, known as Vanuatu since 1980, is still extant. It is centered on a messianic figure called John Frum. References to John Frum in official government records go back only as far as 1940, but even for so recent a myth, it is not known for certain whether he ever existed as a real man. One legend described him as a little man with a high-pitched voice and bleached hair, wearing a coat with shining buttons. He made strange prophecies, and he went out of his way to turn the people against the missionaries. Eventually, he returned to the ancestors, after promising a triumphal second coming, bearing bountiful cargo. His apocalyptic vision included a great cataclysm, the mountains would fall flat, and the valleys would be filled. Old people would regain their youth, and sickness would vanish. The white people would be expelled from the island, never to return. And cargo would arrive in great quantity, so that everybody would have as much as he wanted. Most worryingly for the government, John Frum also prophesied that, on his second coming, he would bring a new coinage stamped with the image of a coconut. The people must therefore get rid of all their money of the white man's currency. In 1941, this led to a wild spending spree. The people stopped working, and the island's economy was seriously damaged. The colonial administrators arrested the ringleaders, but nothing that they could do would kill the cult, and the mission churches and schools became deserted. A little later, a new doctrine grew up that John Frum was King of America. Providentially, American troops arrived in the New Hebrides around this time, and, wonder of wonders, they included black men, who were not poor like the islanders, but
as richly endowed with cargo as the white soldiers. Wild excitement overwhelmed Tanna. The day of the apocalypse was imminent. It seemed that everyone was preparing for the arrival of John Frum. One of the leaders said that John Frum would be coming from America by aeroplane, and hundreds of men began to clear the bush in the center of the island so that the plane might have an airstrip on which to land.
The airstrip had a bamboo control tower with air traffic controllers wearing dummy headphones made of wood. There were dummy planes on the runway to act as decoys, designed to lure down John Frum's plane. In the 1950s, the young David Attenborough sailed to Tanna with a cameraman, Geoffrey Mulligan, to investigate the cult of John Frum. They found plenty of evidence of the religion and were eventually introduced to its high priest, a man called Nambas. Nambas referred to his messiah familiarly as John and claimed to speak regularly to him by radio. This radio belonged John, consisted of an old woman with an electric wire around her waist, who would fall into a trance and talk gibberish, which Nambas interpreted as the words of John Frum. Nambas claimed to have known in advance that Attenborough was coming to see him, because John Frum had told him on the radio. Attenborough asked to see the radio, but was, understandably, refused. He changed the subject and asked whether Nambas had seen John Frum.
Nambas nodded vigorously. Me see him plenty time. What does he look like? Nambas jabbed his finger at me. He look like you. He got white face. He tall man. He live long South America.
This detail contradicts the legend referred to above, that John Frum was a short man. Such is the way with evolving legends. It is believed that the day of John Frum's return will be the 15th of February, but the year is unknown. Every year, on 15th of February, his followers assemble for a religious ceremony to welcome him. So far he has not returned, but they are not downhearted. David Attenborough said to one cult devotee called Sam,
But Sam, it is 19 years since John say that the cargo will come. He promise and he promise, but still the cargo does not come. Isn't 19 years a long time to wait? Sam lifted his eyes from the ground and looked at me. If you can wait 2,000 years for Jesus Christ to come, and he no come, then I can wait more than 19 years for John.
Robert Buckman's book, "Can we be good without God?" quotes the same admirable retort by a John Frum disciple, this time to a Canadian journalist some 40 years after David Attenborough's encounter. The Queen and Prince Philip visited the area in 1974, and the Prince subsequently became deified in a rerun of a John Frum-type cult. Once again, note how rapidly the details in religious evolution can change. The Prince is a handsome man who would have cut an imposing figure in his white naval uniform and plumed helmet, and it is perhaps not surprising that he, rather than the Queen, was elevated in this way, quite apart from the fact that the culture of the islanders made it difficult for them to accept a female deity. I don't want to make too much of the cargo cults of the South Pacific, but they do provide a fascinating contemporary model for the way religions spring up from almost nothing. In particular, they suggest four lessons about the origin of religions generally, and I'll set them out briefly here. First is the amazing speed with which a cult can spring up. Second is the speed with which the origination process covers its tracks. John Frum, if he existed at all, did so within living memory. Yet even for so recent a possibility, it is not certain whether he lived at all. The third lesson springs from the independent emergence of similar cults on different islands. The systematic study of these similarities can tell us something about human psychology and its susceptibility to religion. Fourth, the cargo cults are similar not just to each other, but to older religions. Christianity and other ancient religions that have spread worldwide presumably began as local cults like that of John Frum. Indeed, scholars such as Geza Vermesh, professor of Jewish studies at Oxford University, have suggested that Jesus was one of many such charismatic figures who emerged in Palestine around his time, surrounded by similar legends. Most of those cults died away. The one that survived on this view is the one that we encounter today. And as the centuries go by, it has been honed by further evolution, mimetic selection if you like that way of putting it, not if you don't, into the sophisticated system, or rather diverging sets of descendant systems, that dominate large parts of the world today. The deaths of charismatic modern figures such as Haile Selassie, Elvis Presley, and Princess Diana offer other opportunities to study the rapid rise of cults and their subsequent mimetic evolution. That is all I want to say about the roots of religion itself, apart from a brief reprise in Chapter 10, when I discuss the imaginary friend phenomenon of childhood under the heading of the psychological needs that religion fulfills. Morality is often thought to have its roots in religion, and in the next chapter I want to question this view. I shall argue that the origin of morality can itself be the subject of a Darwinian question. Just as we asked, what is the Darwinian survival value of religion, so we can ask the same question of morality. Morality, indeed, probably predated religion. Just as with religion we drew back from the question and rephrased it, so with morality we shall find that it is best seen as a byproduct of something else. Chapter 6. The Roots of Morality. Why Are We Good?
Strange is our situation here on Earth. Each of us comes for a short visit, not knowing why, yet sometimes seeming to divine a purpose. From the standpoint of daily life, however, there is one thing we do know, that man is here for the sake of other men, above all for those upon whose smiles and well-being our own happiness depends. Albert Einstein.
Many religious people find it hard to imagine how, without religion, one can be good, or would even want to be good. I shall discuss such questions in this chapter, but the doubts go further and drive some religious people to paroxysms of hatred against those who don't share their faith. This is important because moral considerations lie hidden behind religious attitudes to other topics that have no real link with morality. A great deal of the opposition to the teaching of evolution has no connection with evolution itself or with anything scientific, but is spurred on by moral outrage. This ranges from the naive, if you teach children that they evolved from monkeys, then they will act like monkeys, to the more sophisticated underlying motivation for the whole wedge strategy of intelligent design, as it is mercilessly laid bare by Barbara Forrest and Paul Gross in creationism's Trojan horse, the wedge of intelligent design. I receive a large number of letters from readers of my books, most of them enthusiastically friendly, some of them helpfully critical, a few nasty or even vicious. And the nastiest of all, I'm sorry to report, are almost invariably motivated by religion. Such unchristian abuse is commonly experienced by those who are perceived as enemies of Christianity. Here, for example, is a letter posted on the internet and addressed to Brian Fleming, author and director of The God Who Wasn't There, a sincere and moving film advocating atheism. Titled Burn While We Laugh and dated 21st of December 2005, the letter to Fleming reads as follows.
You've definitely got some nerve. I'd love to take a knife, gut you fools, and scream with joy as your insides spill out in front of you. You are attempting to ignite a holy war in which someday I and others like me may have the pleasure of taking action like the above mentioned.
The writer at this point seems to come to a belated recognition that his language is not very Christian, for he goes on more charitably.
However, God teaches us not to seek vengeance, but to pray for those like you all.
His charity is short-lived, however.
I'll get comfort in knowing that the punishment God will bring to you will be 1,000 times worse than anything I can inflict. The best part is that you will suffer for eternity for those sins that you're completely ignorant about. The wrath of God will show no mercy. For your sake, I hope the truth is revealed to you before the knife connects with your flesh. Merry Christmas! P.S. You people really don't have a clue as to what is in store for you. I thank God I'm not you.
I find it genuinely puzzling that a mere difference of theological opinion can generate such venom. Here's a sample from the postbag of the editor of the magazine Free Thought Today, published by the Freedom from Religion Foundation, FFRF, which campaigns peacefully against the undermining of the constitutional separation of church and state.
Hello, cheese-eating scumbags. There are way more of us Christians than you losers. There is no separation of church and state, and you heathens will lose.
What is it with cheese? American friends have suggested to me a connection with the notoriously liberal state of Wisconsin, home of the FFRF, and center of the dairy industry. But surely there must be more to it than that. And how about those French cheese-eating surrender monkeys? What is the semiotic iconography of cheese? To continue.
Satan-worshipping scum, please die and go to hell. I hope you get a painful disease like rectal cancer and die a slow, painful death so you can meet your god, Satan. Hey, dude, this freedom from religion thing sucks. So, you fags and dykes, take it easy and watch where you go, 'cause whenever you least expect it, God will get you. If you don't like this country and what it was founded on and for, get the fuck out of it and go straight to hell. P.S. Fuck you, you communist whore. Get your black asses out of the USA. You are without excuse. Creation is more than enough evidence of the Lord Jesus Christ's omnipotent power.
Why not Allah's omnipotent power, or Lord Brahma's, or even Yahweh's?
We will not go quietly away. If in the future that requires violence, just remember you brought it on. My rifle is loaded.
Why, I can't help wondering, is God thought to need such ferocious defence? One might have supposed him amply capable of looking after himself. Bear in mind through all this that the editor, being abused and threatened so viciously, is a gentle and charming young woman. Perhaps because I don't live in America, most of my hate mail is not quite in the same league, but nor does it display to advantage the charity for which the founder of Christianity was notable. The following, dated May 2005 from a British medical doctor, while it is certainly hateful, strikes me as more tormented than nasty, and reveals how the whole issue of morality is a deep wellspring of hostility towards atheism. After some preliminary paragraphs excoriating evolution, and sarcastically asking whether a Negro is still in the process of evolving, insulting Darwin personally, misquoting Huxley as an anti-evolutionist, and encouraging me to read a book, I have read it, which argues that the world is only 8,000 years old, can he really be a doctor? He concludes,
"Your own books, your prestige in Oxford, everything you love in life and have ever achieved, are an exercise in total futility." Camus' question challenge becomes inescapable. Why don't we all commit suicide? Indeed, your worldview has that sort of effect on students and many others. That we all evolved by blind chance from nothing and returned to nothing. Even if religion were not true, it is better, much, much better, to believe a noble myth, like Plato's, if it leads to peace of mind while we live. But your worldview leads to anxiety, drug addiction, violence, nihilism, hedonism, Frankenstein science, and hell on earth, and World War III. I wonder how happy you are in your personal relationships. Divorced? Widowed? Gay? Those like you are never happy, or they would not try so hard to prove there is no happiness nor meaning in anything.
The sentiment of this letter, if not its tone, is typical of many. Darwinism, this person believes, is inherently nihilistic, teaching that we evolve by blind chance and are annihilated when we die. For the umpteenth time, natural selection is the very opposite of a chance process. As a direct consequence of such alleged negativity, all manner of evils follow. Presumably, he didn't really mean to suggest that widowhood could follow directly from my Darwinism, but his letter, by this point, had reached that level of frenzied malevolence which I repeatedly recognize among my Christian correspondents. I have devoted a whole book, Unweaving the Rainbow, to ultimate meaning, to the poetry of science, and to rebutting specifically and at length the charge of nihilistic negativity, so I shall restrain myself here. This chapter is about evil and its opposite, good, about morality, where it comes from, why we should embrace it, and whether we need religion to do so. Does our moral sense have a Darwinian origin? Several books, including Robert Heinz's Why Good is Good, Michael Shermer's The Science of Good and Evil, Robert Buckman's Can We Be Good Without God, and Mark Hauser's Moral Minds, have argued that our sense of right and wrong can be derived from our Darwinian past. This section is my own version of the argument. On the face of it, the Darwinian idea that evolution is driven by natural selection seems ill-suited to explain such goodness as we possess, or our feelings of morality, decency, empathy, and pity. Natural selection can easily explain hunger, fear, and sexual lust, all of which straightforwardly contribute to our survival or the preservation of our genes. But what about the wrenching compassion we feel when we see an orphan child weeping, an old widow in despair from loneliness, or an animal whimpering in pain? What gives us the powerful urge to send an anonymous gift of money or clothes to tsunami victims on the other side of the world whom we shall never meet and who are highly unlikely to return the favor? Where does the Good Samaritan in us come from? Isn't goodness incompatible with the theory of the selfish gene? No, this is a common misunderstanding of the theory, a distressing and with hindsight foreseeable misunderstanding. It is necessary to put the stress on the right word. The selfish gene is the correct emphasis, for it makes the contrast with the selfish organism, say, or the selfish species. Let me explain.
The logic of Darwinism concludes that the unit in the hierarchy of life, which survives and passes through the filter of natural selection, will tend to be selfish. The units that survive in the world will be the ones that succeeded in surviving at the expense of their rivals at their own level in the hierarchy. That, precisely, is what selfish means in this context. The question is, what is the level of the action? The whole idea of the selfish gene, with the stress properly applied to the last word, is that the unit of natural selection, i.e. the unit of self-interest, is not the selfish organism, not the selfish group or selfish species or selfish ecosystem, but the selfish gene. It is the gene that, in the form of information, either survives for many generations or does not. Unlike the gene and arguably the meme, the organism, the group, and the species are not the right kind of entity to serve as a unit in this sense, because they do not make exact copies of themselves and do not compete in a pool of such self-replicating entities. That is precisely what genes do, and that is the essentially logical justification for singling the gene out as the unit of selfishness in the special Darwinian sense of selfish. The most obvious way in which genes ensure their own selfish survival relative to other genes is by programming individual organisms to be selfish. There are indeed many circumstances in which survival of the individual organism will favor the survival of the genes that ride inside it. But different circumstances favor different tactics. There are circumstances, not particularly rare, in which genes ensure their own selfish survival by influencing organisms to behave altruistically. Those circumstances are now fairly well understood, and they fall into two main categories. A gene that programs individual organisms to favor their genetic kin is statistically likely to benefit copies of itself. Such a gene's frequency can increase in the gene pool to the point where kin altruism becomes the norm. Being good to one's own children is the obvious example, but it's not the only one. Bees, wasps, ants, termites, and to a lesser extent, certain vertebrates such as naked mole rats, meerkats, and acorn woodpeckers, have evolved societies in which elder siblings care for younger siblings, with whom they are likely to share the genes for doing the caring. In general, as the late W.D. Hamilton showed, animals tend to care for, defend, share resources with, warn of danger, or otherwise show altruism towards close kin because of the statistical likelihood that kin will share copies of the same genes. The other main type of altruism for which we have a well-worked-out Darwinian rationale is reciprocal altruism. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. This theory, first introduced to evolutionary biology by Robert Trivers and often expressed in the mathematical language of game theory, does not depend upon shared genes. Indeed, it works just as well, probably even better, between members of widely different species, when it is often called symbiosis. The principle is the basis of all trade and barter in humans, too. The hunter needs a spear, and the smith wants meat. The asymmetry brokers a deal. The bee needs nectar, and the flower needs pollinating. Flowers can't fly, so they pay bees in the currency of nectar for the hire of their wings. Birds called honey guides can find bees' nests but can't break into them. Honey badgers, Raytels, can break into bees' nests but lack wings with which to search for them. Honey guides lead Raytels, and sometimes men, to honey by a special enticing flight used for no other purpose. Both sides benefit from the transaction. A crock of gold may lie under a large stone too heavy for its discoverer to move. He enlists the help of others, even though he then has to share the gold, because without their help, he would get none. The living kingdoms are rich in such mutualistic relationships. Buffaloes and oxpeckers, red tubular flowers and hummingbirds, groupers and cleaner wrasses, cows and their gut microorganisms. Reciprocal altruism works because of asymmetries in needs and incapacities to meet them. That is why it works especially well between different species. The asymmetries are greater.
In humans, IOUs and money are devices that permit delays in the transactions. The parties to the trade don't hand over the goods simultaneously, but can hold a debt over to the future, or even trade the debt on to others. As far as I know, no non-human animals in the wild have any direct equivalent of money. But memory of individual identity plays the same role more informally. Vampire bats learn which other individuals of their social group can be relied upon to pay their debts, in regurgitated blood, and which individuals cheat. Natural selection favors genes that predispose individuals, in relationships of asymmetric need and opportunity, to give when they can, and to solicit giving when they can't. It also favors tendencies to remember obligations, bear grudges, police exchange relationships, and punish cheats who take but don't give when their turn comes. For there will always be cheats, and stable solutions to the game-theoretic conundrums of reciprocal altruism always involve an element of punishment of cheats. Mathematical theory allows two broad classes of stable solutions to games of this kind. Stable means that, once it exceeds a critical frequency in the population, no alternative does better. Always Be Nasty is stable, in that if everybody else is doing it, a single nice individual cannot do better. But there is another strategy which is also stable. This is the strategy, start out being nice and give others the benefit of the doubt, then repay good deeds with good, but avenge bad deeds. In game theory language, this strategy, or family of related strategies, goes under various names including tit-for-tat, retaliator, and reciprocator. It is evolutionarily stable under some conditions in the sense that, given a population dominated by reciprocators, no single nasty individual and no single unconditionally nice individual will do better. There are other, more complicated variants of tit-for-tat which can, in some circumstances, do better. I've mentioned kinship and reciprocation as the twin pillars of altruism in a Darwinian world, but there are secondary structures which rest atop those main pillars. Especially in human society, with language and gossip, reputation is important. One individual may have a reputation for kindness and generosity. Another individual may have a reputation for unreliability, for cheating and reneging on deals. Another may have a reputation for generosity when trust has been built up, but for ruthless punishment of cheating. The unadorned theory of reciprocal altruism expects animals of any species to base their behavior upon unconscious responsiveness to such traits in their fellows. In human societies, we add the power of language to spread reputations, usually in the form of gossip. You don't need to have suffered personally from X's failure to buy his round at the pub. You hear, on the grapevine, that X is a tightwad. Or, to add an ironic complication to the example, that Y is a terrible gossip. Reputation is important, and biologists can acknowledge a Darwinian survival value in not just being a good reciprocator, but fostering a reputation as a good reciprocator too. Matt Ridley's The Origins of Virtue, as well as being a lucid account of the whole field of Darwinian morality, is especially good on reputation. Reputation is not confined to humans. It has recently been shown to apply to one of the classic cases of reciprocal altruism in animals, the symbiotic relationship between small, cleaner fish and their large fish clients. In an ingenious experiment, individual cleaner wrasse, Labroides dimidiatus, that had been observed by a would-be client to be diligent cleaners, were more likely to be chosen by the client than rival Labroides that had been observed neglecting to clean.
The Norwegian economist Thorstein Veblen, and in a rather different way the Israeli zoologist Amot Zahavi, have added a further fascinating idea. Altruistic giving may be an advertisement of dominance or superiority. Anthropologists know it as the potlatch effect, named after the custom whereby rival chieftains of Pacific Northwest tribes vie with each other in duels of ruinously generous feasts. In extreme cases, bouts of retaliatory entertaining continue until one side is reduced to penury, leaving the winner not much better off. Veblen's concept of conspicuous consumption strikes a chord with many observers of the modern scene. Zahavi's contribution, unregarded by biologists for many years until vindicated by brilliant mathematical models from the theorist Alan Graffen, has been to provide an evolutionary version of the potlatch idea. Zahavi studies Arabian babblers, little brown birds who live in social groups and breed cooperatively. Like many small birds, babblers give warning cries, and they also donate food to each other. A standard Darwinian investigation of such altruistic acts would look first for reciprocation and kinship relationships among the birds. When a babbler feeds a companion, is it in the expectation of being fed at a later date? Or is the recipient of the favor a close genetic relative? Zahavi's interpretation is radically unexpected. Dominant babblers assert their dominance by feeding subordinates. To use the sort of anthropomorphic language Zahavi delights in, the dominant bird is saying the equivalent of, "Look how superior I am to you, I can afford to give you food." Or, "Look how superior I am, I can afford to make myself vulnerable to hawks by sitting on a high branch acting as a sentinel, to warn the rest of the flock feeding on the ground. The observations of Zahavi and his colleagues suggest that babblers actively compete for the dangerous role of sentinel, and when